episode 3 of the Talentopoly podcast, where we discuss some of the best links posted on talentopoly.com each week. I'm Jared Brown, the founder of talentopoly.com. You can find me on Twitter at Jared Brown and on the web at jaredbrown.me.
And I'm Stephen Dixon, a web designer and front-end developer from the UK. You can check me out on Twitter at Stephen M. Dixon and also on my website, stephenmdixon.com.
And I'm Brandon Corbin, the creator of the 8ify podcast, and you can check that out at 8ify.com. That's the number 8ify.com.
So what are you guys drinking tonight?
Can I go first?
Absolutely.
Got a lot of caffeine in it. I'm actually having a Cellar number 8, and it's a Cabernet from California, 2008, and it's almost half gone.
Nice.
It's like a $9.99 wine. So if you're looking for a cheap wine, it's got a decent flavor. And I've bought it multiple times now, and that's rare for me because I usually have no brand loyalty.
Very nice. And what are you drinking, Steve?
I am drinking 100% British barley, a.k.a. Carling. Very nice. Nice and cool. What about you?
What does that taste like? What type of beer is that?
It's a lager. I'll give it a quick sample now, shall I? It tastes smooth. It's nice and smooth and not really bitter either, and it's not too fizz bang. So it kind of, you know, it means you can drink more and not have to worry about getting rid of the gas. So.
Awesome.
That is always important.
It's the beer that doesn't give you gas.
Yep. Awesome.
What about you, Jared?
I am drinking a beer that I made with a friend a couple of months ago, about 3 months ago now. I had it refrigerated this whole time. And it is a Fat Tire clone, which came out all right. It's not the best beer that I've made two beers now with my friend, and we did a triple before this one that came out really good, and this one came out okay. And that is what I am enjoying during this podcast. So, in case the listeners can't tell the difference, I do have a new mic this week, which I was pretty excited about getting.
Yay!
Got the same setup as Brandon. He convinced me to get a proper mic for the podcast. And it's really great. It's the Rode Podcaster with the shock mount. I got a little $11 stand for it and the pop filter to go along with it. I think the whole thing was high 200s, like $290 for the setup. But if it sounds better, then it's worth every penny.
It sounds so good.
Nice.
I'm jealous. I'm insanely jealous. Can you tell the jealousy from my voice?
Yes, because you sound like you're talking through a tin can.
Oh, thanks.
Or an iPad.
Or an iPad.
So I signed up for... I was talking to Brandon last night, and while we were talking, I told him about this conference I went to in May called ValeoCon. And it's a designer-developer conference. It was pretty small. It was about 50, 60 people, which was awesome. I thought that was really great that it was nice and small and, you know, kind of a comfortable group of people, not too large. You get lost in the crowd. Well, I was telling him about it, and the early bird tickets had just come out last week. So I bought myself a ticket, and it will be next June in San Diego. So nice warm weather. Hopefully get some time on the beach while I'm there. And I'm excited, and now begins the campaign to convince Steve to fly over to America and attend the conference as well.
How much were the tickets?
They were $900 for 3 nights. It's it's going to be hosted at the Hyatt in Mission Bay, which is I stayed there last year, right the night before we flew out after the conference was over. It's a really nice Hyatt. It's right next to SeaWorld, right on the peninsula there in Mission Bay. Great view. It was a very nice little short vacation, and you get to geek it up all weekend too. So I was pretty happy with it and excited to go back.
So are you a conference whore?
That was the first conference I'd ever been to.
Okay.
And it was such a great experience. but I still am very cautious about. And I've been wanting to go to South by Southwest for a couple of years now, and just could not justify the price for it. This conference last year was only 2 days, and the price I think was $750. I actually bought a 2-ticket pass for $750 and dragged my wife along to some of the some of the conference so that she could get a view into the, like, the inner geekdom. And amazingly, she actually won a prize while she was in the conference. And Kyle Steed, who's a well known for his illustration abilities, drew a hand-drawn portrait of her, which we framed and is hanging up in my house now. So that's kind of cool.
Is it like a caricature where they make her head really big?
No, he tried to draw it proportionate. It's got his artistic style to it, but it looks pretty close. It's pretty good.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Going off the people that go to this convention, I think it, you know, pretty much justifies the price, though, to be honest. I mean, I'd absolutely kill to be in a room with these kinds of people.
Yeah.
Especially like the topics they discuss. And, yeah, you know what I mean? It's just, I see its worth, and you all should see its worth too. So there we go.
Yeah. And this is not an ad. This is just, I was kind of excited about the fact that I'm going to it and wanted to talk about it again. But so last week we were talking about Apple and how they stepped up to defend their developers from the evil Lodsys Corporation, who's trying to sue multiple iOS developers claiming patent infringement. And we were wondering what Google was going to do, because Lodsys is suing Android developers as well. And this week news came out that Google is going to step up and start defending those developers on their platform. So I thought that was really good news.
Yeah, they really didn't have a choice, honestly, is the way I see it. If they didn't, I mean, that would have just been an embarrassment.
Yeah, yeah. It would have been almost a stake to the heart of, you know, you don't make as much money from from all of the articles that I see people publish who are Android devs as you would if you're doing iOS development. And now if they don't even protect you from lawsuits, you know, that would be a huge blow to their platform. So that was great news to see that they are going to step up and throw their army of lawyers at Lodsys, as well as Apple's doing the same. And, you know, good luck, Lodsys, in those lawsuits. So with that, we jump into our first article. Google to buy Motorola Mobility for $12.5 billion.
I've got a question real quick. The Motorola Mobility, is there a difference between Motorola Mobility and Motorola as a corporation? Or is this Motorola the whole soup and nuts?
This is just a department of Motorola, just their mobile department.
Okay.
And they had been looking to spin this off for a while now. I don't think it's highly profitable at the moment. They seem to have a couple of good phones out there from what I hear from my Android friends, but HTC and Samsung are definitely ahead of the pack, and Motorola was not that enthusiastic about this department. So they've been looking to sell this off to somebody for a while.
I have, one of the interesting points that I heard was, so people were saying, you know, could this just have been because they lost out to the Nortel patents, which we have on point A in our notes here. They say, you know, you don't just go and buy somebody like this that quickly. So it very well could have been that they got into the Nortel things just to bump the price up, because they had to be working on this Motorola deal before that even went down, which I thought, if that's the case, then that really does make them a significantly smarter, business savvy people than we might have thought.
That is the point that Dan Lyon made, the guy who is also known as the fake Steve Jobs. He wrote an article earlier this week basically making that point, saying that Google had been talking to them for a while and was just playing around. And, you know, a lot of people had heard about the bids that Google was submitting during the Nortel patent auction, and they were the number pi carried out to so many decimal places in billions, and, you know, there was the distance between things. But John Gruber and M.G. Siegler, John Gruber from Daring Fireball and M.G. Siegler from TechCrunch, both wrote articles saying that that was bullshit. That basically they had been in low-level talks with Motorola for a while now. but high-level talks definitely started, and this is according to Om Malik, who has supposedly pretty good sources within Google. High-level talks did not start until after they lost the Nortel patents. And this is definitely, according to those three people who are claiming sources within Google, this is a reaction to losing the Nortel patent auction.
Well, there you go.
So that is the latest. All of this is just coming off of blogs, and you know, this is not straight from the companies, but that is supposedly what is happening here. There was a good article on Slate also talking about how $12.5 billion for 17,000 patents is roughly the same. They're paying about three times more than what the Nortel patents went for, which were slightly over $4 billion. Mm. But they're getting about three times more the patents as well. So it's about roughly the same price per patent. But amazingly, I was kind of amazed to hear this, is that Google is spending, that $12.5 billion is equivalent to 2 years worth of Google's profits.
Wow.
So this is quite the purchase for them. And everybody's talking about it from the patent perspective. I don't think a lot of people are thinking that this was driven by anything but patents. They can definitely create some nice phones with this capability, having Motorola's industrial design capability and their manufacturing distribution, you know, expertise. But this seems like primarily a patent play that was crucial. Now that they lost out on the Nortel patents, they had to make this move to be able to protect the Android platform from all of those lawsuits that are already happening, and of course, future lawsuits that would happen.
I don't care for Android.
Well, amen, then, brother.
No, we had one, and I forget what it was. I've never really been like blown away by it, and it always seemed like it was more work using the phone, and it was just less enjoyable overall. So hopefully that they now have kind of control over the hardware, they can start doing some of the things that Apple has the benefit of by doing both, where you can really kind of get the two to harmonize nicely together.
Right. I'm kind of holding out hope, because I liked what Google did with the Nexus phones, the Nexus 1 and the Nexus 2. I think they were widely considered by the Android community to be top tier hardware for the Android platform. I'm really looking forward to and hoping that Motorola brings to them the ability to in-house make a really great, call it a spec phone, but actually a consumer phone that leads the way and creates a standard, raises the bar for all of the other Android phone makers, including HTC and Samsung, and make them reach a little further.
Just bear in mind that the Nexus, that was done by HTC, so obviously right. that build, HTC's got, you know, fairly decent build quality. So I said this on Twitter, and you can shoot me down for this, but I said on Twitter, you know, this acquisition, basically Google's bought a crummy company that creates crummy handsets, and they're going to put a crummy operating system on it. So I've never had even pre iPhone, I've never been fond of Motorola's devices. I've just seen them as mediocre and stuff. So, you know, that's where I stand.
Well, they said they're going to allow Motorola Mobility to continue to run as a separate company. Clearly, electronics manufacturing is not a strong suit for Google. It's not something that they've been doing before. I wonder if this is kind of the beginning of the end, the dismantling of Motorola Mobility, and they just say thanks for the patents, and a couple of years from now, they're a footnote somewhere. Or do you think this Motorola Mobility department will be able to continue to succeed being under Google?
I think that if they actually had, you know, attention put to them and the resources that Google has behind it, that absolutely they could probably turn it around. I'm just not convinced that that the company itself has, you know, like you just said, that the hardware, you know, other than their Google Enterprise appliance, they don't really have that kind of expertise. And but hell, they've got enough money; they can hire the experts,
right? Yeah, buy them and then hire the rest.
Yeah,
I think you make a good point with regards to, you know, the purchase being just for patents. I mean, it seems perfectly feasible for Google to kind of just liquefy Motorola Mobility and then kind of use all those patents in an onslaught against a much better handset that's out there now. So I think that is the way it's going to go.
Now, when it comes to fairness, a couple of the, I'm sure the other handset makers are wondering, oh, is Motorola Mobility, once they get acquired by Google, going to get early access to the Android OS? And Google right now is saying that won't be the case. That's part of the reason why they want to keep them as a separate entity, is to really draw that line there. But it seems almost inevitable that they're going to get early previews or hear through the grapevine what's coming their way. And ultimately, isn't a vertical solution where the hardware and the software is being developed in concert going to be more beneficial to the Android platform anyway?
If they make those specs available to the other guys, I think. I mean, you could definitely see if they get insights and stuff that the others don't, then they could just finally say, you know what, screw this. We're going to go run on Windows Mobile Phone 7 2008, whatever the hell they call it. So maybe if they try to take it, you know, from more of an open standard like they've been trying to do with a lot of the things they're building, that could be an interesting angle. I don't know. I guess only time will tell.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch that. I was also a little blown away by how much they value the Android platform. Clearly, they're putting a price tag on it right now and saying it's worth at least $12.5 billion to protect it. I don't see where. I know that there are a lot of Google services tied into the Android platform, and the more phones they sell, the more Google searches that are done, and the more Google Docs and Gmail users there are. How long is that going to take to repay $12.5 billion on an OS that you give out for free?
I guess it all comes down to how many ads it can display.
It's kind of crazy that it can, that they see it making that much in the near future. But
I think that'd be crazy if Google didn't use Motorola's, facilities and to create create the hardware, and obviously they do the software. It just seems bizarre that they'd spend this much money and not actually do that.
Right.
Yeah. In the process, yeah, they're going to pee a lot of the other guys off. But I don't know. It just depends. You know, I don't think it's how much money you value your platform for, but how much investment you want to put into your platform and buying Motorola and developing like an Android phone using Motorola's facilities, I think is the most logical way to go. But if they don't, then, they fool them.
Right.
Apple. I'll tell you what, the moment that they actually create something that's better than the iPhone, I would love that. I would love to see that if they could turn this into something that could generate phones that are better than the iPhone. I think that'd be phenomenal. Now, do I see that happening anytime soon? No, because Apple set the bar so incredibly high. But it could be finally getting us to that point where, you know, we have actual phones that are, you know, real usability, competitiveness to the iPhone.
Absolutely. Apple makes almost $400 off the sale of each iPhone. I think the $12.5 billion is going to have to, in part, be repaid by them selling a fairly competitive phone and making $100, $200 off of the sale of each one. I think that will go a long way to helping to repay this purchase, and they must be thinking that.
Yep. Well, and that concludes this week in mobile.
All right, next article. Our next article is Slim, a fast, lightweight template engine for Ruby. Slim is a lot like Haml, if you're familiar with Haml. It's a non-HTML markup language that creates HTML. Slim is supposedly faster and less verbose than writing Haml, and which is saying something because Haml is the most popular templating engine in Ruby currently. But this looks very interesting. This looks like something I want to try out.
So here, and you guys can call me old fashioned, but I absolutely hate these concepts. The mere fact that I don't want to do a greater than or less than sign drives me crazy. And the main reason it drives me crazy is it's great once you as a single developer understand it, learn it, and are able to build on it. Yes, you are more efficient, but that doesn't take into consideration everybody else in the world, right? We've got standards for a very good reason, and it's because we all can agree, yes, this is the way that we're going to do that. So if you give me your now Slim, and I've been working in HTML, or hell, I've been working in HAML, and now I've got to go and learn a whole new language to generate HTML. It's simple. If you guys are if the developers don't want to sit there and spend their time making their little, you know, their greater than or less than signs, then give it to the HTML guys that do. So I'm annoyed as hell by these things. I understand their efficiency, and the same thing goes with, you know, the CSS ones that are out there. It's like, oh, I never want to do a squirrely bracket again. It's like, ugh, because again, they're standards for a very good reason. When I leave the company or I bring other people on, now I've got to invest in them, trying to spend it and learn it. And so, yes, I think these are an awful idea. HTML is easy enough. CSS is easy enough that you don't need to have some newfangled technology that makes it, you know, less verbose, right? It's pretty friggin' less verbose as it is. That's my take on it.
Okay. Well, this, I think it comes back a lot to the Rails mantra of work on developer efficiency versus computer efficiency. Even though it might take the computer a little bit longer to process it, if you can code faster because of it, that's the end all be all. And I think that's the promise of something like Slim and Haml, of using these templating languages. If you write less, you can write more in the same amount of time. Do you buy into that, or you say that's just bullshit?
I say that's bullshit as well. I mean, just because, again, if we're doing this right anyway, our HTML should – I mean, the HTML that we are writing comparatively to everything else that we're doing should be fairly small. I have a real kind of hard time with it, and mainly the reason being that it's just we've built up all of these years of coming up with standards where we all can agree, and now every time we turn around, there's going to be somebody else that's come out with, hey, now you don't have to type A, and we'll automatically be able to insert A wherever it's required, right, just by some black magic or, you know, something else, and we're all going to have to sit there and say, okay, well, now this is the new standard. It's like, you know, I don't want to have to learn a new way of writing JavaScript. I don't want to have to learn a new way of writing CSS every time somebody gets a bug up their ass to come up with a new lightweight templating engine.
Right. So SAS and CoffeeScript and Slim.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And honestly, programming with white space freaks me out a little bit. But that's besides the point.
Yeah. I like Python, but I have not gotten used to the white space, being the scope. Setting the scope for it.
Exactly. I'm not a huge fan of these. Again, I think, you know, if it's helping me write my code faster, I'm okay with that. And I can accept that argument. I can even accept the argument of CoffeeScript. But when it comes to HTML, come on. You know, really, it's not that friggin' hard.
Right. What I did find interesting is Slim is based on something called Temple. I'd never heard of that before, so I looked it up, and it is a framework for compiling templates to pure Ruby. So essentially, if you don't like any of the existing templates out there, and unlike Brandon, you do like using templates, you can go and make your own template to be exactly the markup that you want, which would be
HTML.
Okay, so Brandon would just go make HTML again.
Can you render my HTML into HTML? That would be phenomenal. Thank you.
Excellent. So our next article is Chrome 14 brings native code to the web. This is the new build of Chrome, which this is in the beta channel right now. This is not a stable release for mass consumption, but it has native code built into it. And what native code is the ability to run compiled C and C++ libraries directly within Chrome. So you don't have to just use JavaScript to do your fancy programming. You can now use very fast C and C++ code. What do you think about this, Brandon?
Game changer. And if Firefox and the Safari crew or the WebKit, you know, crew are not trying to figure out how we can incorporate this, they're going to be kicking themselves, because this very well could be, you know, back in the day when we were writing application, I'm the old dude. It's great that, you know, okay, well, we're just going to write it and it has to run in IE. you know, because, you know, we're using some proprietary stuff or whatever. But there was this, and that's one thing that really did help Internet Explorer kind of maintain its power, that this could be that thing where if we can start bringing application, desktop application level functionality besides just, you know, Flash and Flex and all of that, this really could be a great game changer. And since C and C++ are so readily available, I don't know why everybody else wouldn't say, okay, let's just try to follow along here so we can all have like this, the benefit of what we're going to get from here. So I think this is killer.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a game changer. I am looking forward to it because you have right now the only apps I actually still install on my computer are productivity and game applications. And if I could do more of that right in a browser where my data is already in the cloud, if I can have more of my apps in the cloud where any browser, let's say I could load up Final Cut Pro, the equivalent of that in a browser, and edit my video from anywhere, that would be huge.
Yeah, agreed completely. I look forward to it. Now, do they have any good examples? I haven't actually checked it out yet.
I looked at it today, and I couldn't run any of them. I don't have Chrome 14 installed, but the examples were pretty disappointing. They only had three, one of which was Hello World. They had a Pi simulator, a sine wave grapher, and I don't even remember what the other one looked retarded. They were pretty bad. I was expecting some video game or something.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you can definitely see where video games will, you know, in the browser, they're getting so much better. But yeah, the video production, hell, audio production, just any kind of thing. So yeah, anyway, it'll be interesting to see what people actually do with it. Maybe, you know, by the time it's really mass adopted, all of the C and C++ developers will have died. but maybe not, you know, so who knows? It'll be interesting to see where it goes.
It will. And I'm sure somebody like John Carmack is going to blow our minds by doing Quake. And I know he's already done it using Canvas with HTML5, and I bet that he can further blow our minds using native code, and I look forward to it. Our next article is Adobe Muse, which is a tool for print designers to create websites. What do you think about this, Steve?
Well, I've got a big opinion on this one. I checked it out, obviously, as a new web design kind of tool, and basically, as you just said, it's for print designers to get themselves into getting in, you know, into web design. one word describes this whole project, and that is awful. You should see the markup that Muse creates. what annoys me the most is just the naive attitude Adobe has to things like this. For example, in one of their videos, you know, demonstrating the product, they actually said this product is for that small gap in between the print designer to the web designer, you know, as if they're both one and the same thing. but as any good web designer, web developer knows, you know, having great clean code is huge, and obviously it cuts down on load times and a slew of other things. I'm just not impressed at all. I mean, have you guys played around with it and checked it out?
No, and I don't think I ever would use something like this. I wonder, I would have loved to have been in the meeting when they first dreamt up this product. And somebody, I'm sure, came from, is it InDesign is one of the Adobe mm-hmm. products? Print designers use that. And I'm sure that group was getting requests, and those people want to go off and make websites. And, you know, could you make us a tool to allow us to create websites? And at what point did they not realize they already have a WYSIWYG editor in Dreamweaver? They already have – we've moved past this point where we want to give people the keys to be able to go and create really crappy brochure-style websites with horrible markup in a WYSIWYG editor. Why did they give us another one of these in 2011? I don't understand this.
Yeah, you know, my only thing that I can say positive about this is that hope maybe if it's a free application that they can give to education, so we can maybe help young kids be able to get out there and build, you know, start building some websites so they can start checking out the, you know, the markup, even though it sucks. but yeah, my overall take on it, that this is that depending on how well they market this, that we could be dealing with another, you know, front page issue here, for the next, you know, 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. I don't think this is a good thing.
Neither do I. I mean, it's just, I mean, if you read the copy on the site, create websites as easily as you can create layouts for print. You can design and publish original HTML pages to the latest web standards without writing code. Right, okay. Oh, dear. What? And how much are they going to charge for this?
Yeah, exactly. But
they need to just make it free. Make it free. Use it as an education tool because most likely they're going to come out and say, hey, it's only $5.99, you know, and it's just going to be like, give me a...
The thing which really annoys me is the fact that, yes, if you're a web designer, you need, as a great web designer, as a person you want to move forward in web design, you need to know your limitations in what you can code and what can be coded and created. Otherwise, you're going to create these flamboyant websites that won't ever be able to be built and be great cross browser. Now, if you don't get introduced to the code, I don't think you can honestly become the best web designer that you could be. And these people aren't getting introduced to the code; they're completely bypassing it, so they're never going to learn what their limitations are. And then we're just going to get this slew of websites that are just going to be horrible. And I can't hack it.
Yeah. If you are a print designer, here's my plea. If you're a print designer and you're thinking of doing a website, either learn HTML and web design or hire a good web designer and stick to print design. Don't use Adobe Muse.
Well, I can see all the ad agencies right now are like, oh, this is going to be amazing. You know, and it's, I've got a side project that we're working on right now, and the design totally came from an ad agency, you know, and they're all still just stuck in that static world where boxes don't change sizes based on, you know, font size and whatnot. This really might be an agency play, because I'm still blown away that ad agencies have such shitty web development departments. So it could be that. I mean, they've been classic for, you know, for targeting that market, you know, as hard as they possibly can.
Right.
It's worth noting as well that it's actually the InDesign team that developed Muse as well. So,
okay.
Damn.
Yeah. So our next article is Tiny Fluid Grid. Create your own fluid grid. This is a website. Tiny little web app here that you can specify the number of columns you want in your grid, 12, 16, or 24, your gutter percentage, and your min and max width, and download the style sheet that it generates for you. If 960 grid system or 978 grid system is not cutting it for you, check this out and you can make your very own grid system. So I think it's kind of cool. Do you guys use grid systems at all?
I don't. I want to get into some of the responsive grid systems, but I haven't actually done them yet, just because, you know, I don't like having class names define, okay, you're here, you're here, you're here. But the website that's there, so it's a pretty cool website. It is super simple. It's by the guys, the Girlfriend Inc. out of, I think they're in New York. They're an agency, and they do some pretty awesome work. So I was happy to see them kind of release this, because they obviously use it for a lot of their client work.
I've been using the 960 grid system for Talentopoly, and it helped me work with my designer, because he could load into Photoshop the grid system, design with that template overlaid, you know, all the rulers, all the guides in Photoshop. And then it was much easier, I think, for me to be able to slice that up accordingly and lay it out. It seemed to work pretty well. And they also have a way that you can print out on graph paper the grid system as well. So if you want to do your wireframes and draw them out, you can do that on paper.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah, I don't use grid systems a lot. For me, it all depends on what website you're building, because grid systems don't always work. I don't know. I just never really used them. But yeah, like Jared said, like Brandon said, I want to get into the responsive, the fluid grid systems as well. You know, eventually. So that's something on the list.
And I think it's important to note this can generate a somewhat fluid grid system where you can specify the min and max width. Mm-hmm. So if you resize and I'm trying this out here and resizing the window a little bit, and the grid does change slightly. So some responsiveness there.
There's just one thing I just want to say with regards to the design of the site. It's kind of done as if it's like an app on iOS. Now I'm on my iPad at the minute, and there's a fair few errors with the site. So it's not
working on the iPad.
It is, but for example, the background, like the chrome-ish looking, the shiny background, is kind of cut off where the min and max width bar is. So, guys, if you're listening, get on it.
Awesome. All right, the next article is 10 excellent tools for responsive web design. This definitely goes along with what we were just talking about with the Fluid Grid, and this is a list of some excellent, excellent tools. If you are looking at doing responsive web design, and quick background on that is responsive web design is optimizing your CSS for various screen sizes, most screen sizes, with one set of CSS style sheets. So you don't have to worry about designing a mobile-friendly website as well as your desktop website. You do it all in one set of style sheets, and it's just going to adjust accordingly. And if you are interested in doing this sort of thing, I highly recommend you check out this article because these tools are imperative to doing that.
Yeah, it's a great article. I mean, they've got and a lot of them that are out there are pretty impressive when you start, you know, scaling down your browser window and it all starts collapsing down. And that's definitely high up on my to-do list of learning that, because usually I just have, you know, I have a style sheet and a JavaScript load up if it's this browser or that browser. But to be able to kind of start doing it all in one would be pretty nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the things they talk about in here is lettering.js and fit text. Those are going to resize your fonts for you dynamically. You can do flexible images with image sizer. You can check out some of the grids that they recommend. They have Adobe Device Central is something I hadn't heard about before and is a nice way to test your responsive designs in various devices, including the iPhone, straight from your desktop. So that looks very useful. Just lots of great links in this. Did you guys have something else to add about that?
Nope. It's a good article. Read it.
Awesome. Our next article is font. Identify any web font you see. This is a bookmarklet that you can install. And then when you activate this, you're going to be able to click on any font on any page. And it's got a nice little tooltip that comes up in the top right, telling you which font it is, what size it's at, what if it's bold or not. Gives you a lot of nice information about the font.
This is badass. This is like one of those things where you see and you're like, this has got to be some kind of black magic. I mean, I was blown away with how well it works, and now it's a permanent bookmarklet in my browser. This is a great find.
Have you used something like this, Steve?
Nope. I think we might have lost him again.
All right. Well, we will try to carry on with that.
There we go.
There he is.
Yay. Oh, I've been listening. I've used something like this before. It's I think it's called What the Font.
Mm-hmm.
And you have like an image that you upload and it analyzes, you know, all the different parts of the text that you've just uploaded. That's what I've been using in the past. But, you know, there've been so many times I've just seen an awesome looking font on a website and I've just thought, you know, I'm gonna have to check the source code and the CSS onto what this font is. So something like this is something that every single web designer is going to have in their bookmarks bar, definitely.
I think this is a good reason to even show your bookmarks bar in a modern browser, because I usually don't do that, but with some of these very useful bookmarklets, I've been starting to do that now.
What do you use? How do you manage your bookmarks? Other than talonopoly.com.
I don't bookmark a lot of stuff usually. I've found that I can just search it out later. I used to use Delicious, and I do have a pinboard.in account now, which automatically pulls in anything I favorite on Twitter, and I could go there and put bookmarks into it. I really don't bookmark a lot of stuff, and honestly, the things I do are all technical, and they do go up on Talonopoly, and that satisfies my needs. So,
at talonopoly.com.
Exactly.
Oh, so yes.
Our next article is Box.js, which is a simple package management service. And if that's not ambiguous enough for you, let me explain what it does. It will take your JavaScript and your CSS files and it will minify them and compile them together and host them up on its CDN, which it's using Amazon Web Services for. And then all you do is include this JavaScript snippet, and it will send you the finished production version, that one file for each of those, and include those up in your header to reduce load times.
Have you actually implemented it yet?
I haven't, because I've been planning on doing this sort of thing on Talonopoly, and I hate to admit that right now I pull in a lot of resources, mainly a lot of JavaScript and CSS files. And the reason that I am not quite implementing this yet is because I'm also looking at using SAS to try to do this. I'd like to compile it all before I even do the push up to the server. I don't necessarily want to wait for, I don't want to rely on this to handle the compilation of all that and do it through JavaScript.
The one thing I've found with things like this, and there's another one, and I think it was mentioned in the comments of Talonopoly of this post, is Minify. And they work great when you have a simple, you have a couple different libraries that you're pulling, a couple different jQuery plugins or whatnot. But I found that when you start getting some more complex libraries going in there, that's all of a sudden you just start getting some weird errors and things like that. I think conceptually the idea is really solid. And, I built, that was my foray into Node, is that I built a less server with CSS that did a very similar thing where you just pass it in. My server does the compression, stores it into Amazon, and sends it out. It looks like, the code's really clean and it looks like it could be promising. I've played around with Lab, which is another one. And, I was just doing it on one app that I'm working right now, and I still just kept kind of getting errors. So I'm going to try it with Box.js tonight and just see how well it works.
Excellent. I think things like jQuery, you may still find it advantageous to get that delivered via the Google CDN is how a lot of people get jQuery. Because then it's usually already cached. There's probably no need to compile it in using Box.js.
And that's the thing. So it's like, okay, now we've got this one extra resource that we're waiting on. And so in that case, then Box.js has to wait to finish up. So then you start getting into the blocking problems with it. So there's just weird things like that. And also then, how do you turn relative URLs into absolute URLs? And sometimes that breaks and just weird stuff like that. But I'm always for, simple package management services.
Yeah, you'll have to let us know how it turns out. I'd be interested to hear about that. Our next article is HTML5 Boilerplate version 2 released. The HTML5 Boilerplate really became popular very quickly after it got released. And what it is all of the CSS files, in Boilerplate 1, it was the CSS reset file and standard styles and some of the JavaScript you might need, like Modernizer, to be able to do backwards compatibility in older browsers. People were repeating that a lot in their web projects, and Boilerplate just said, well, here's what you normally want to do. Let's just get this done and out of the way. Just drop this in and you're good. Now version 2 has come out, and they got rid of reset.css. They replaced it with a leaner version that it doesn't reset all of your styles. It just tries to take care of the styles in your browser that need to be tweaked a little bit, normalized a little bit. And so far, I think a lot of people are receiving this quite well. Steve, have you used, in your front-end development, have you used a Boilerplate or any of these common CSS files?
I've dabbled with the HTML5 Boilerplate in the past. But obviously, there's on client side that is, and it all depends on whether, I need to put the time and effort into making a site, in HTML5 for the client. Usually whatever I do now is okay for them. But, I'll hold my hand up and say that I definitely want to implement this Boilerplate in my website. And obviously future projects I do, I'm going to use this because it's great in terms of pushing the standards, pushing the envelope and pushing, web standards forward. Even on the client sites that, they're not going to use, they're not going to get tons of visitors on all sorts of different browsers per se. So something like this is going to be, mega useful for keeping that website up to date and current. I just think the Boilerplate is just a fantastic thing to have. And like I said, hold my hand up, and it's not on my website now, but I'm going to be implementing it as soon as possible because it's just so awesome.
Good stuff.
All right. I'm going to do mine using Adobe Muse.
So, guys, that's even better than HTML5 boilerplate. Go download that. It's in beta.
Do all of your web design in Illustrator and then just throw it, or in InDesign, and just throw it right into Muse, and you're done.
Yeah.
In fact, you don't even have to do that. Just upload the .ai file, and then we'll just download your website. Yes.
Even better.
I think it's called, what was it? PDF.
But no, there's some cool stuff in this. Obviously, with version 2, like you said, Jared, with, you know, putting back the defaults into browsers, because I've never really used a major reset.css file. I don't know if you guys have. I've just never seen to have a use of having that in there with the projects I've done. Obviously, with my own site, it's different. But, you know, something like this where you can just have a set, you know, a set standard of, you know, font sizes and font types, et cetera, across all browsers, and having something like that in the normalized.css file in the HTML5 boilerplate v2 is definitely awesome and a step in the right direction. Very helpful.
Yes. Yeah, I use reset a lot. It's actually one of my shortcuts in CodeIgniter. So I just do reset tab and boom, there it is. But now I am starting to use the normalize code set instead of just the hard reset. So it is nicer. It doesn't like strip out absolutely everything, but it definitely helps kind of give you some consistency across, you know, all the various browsers, especially when we still have to deal with, you know, jackasses using IE6.
You still have to support IE6?
Dude, and in my day job, unfortunately, 20% of our customers' online orders come from Internet Explorer 6.
No.
Yes. Man. Yes. And just that's something for all of us technologists and designers out there to keep in mind, because we like to think that nobody's using it. But then you go into those analytics and you see that, you know, this company that they just made $400,000 this month from, you know, IE6 users. It's like, oh. And so, yeah, we do unfortunately have to make sure the stuff at least works. And that's my whole thing. We'll make it work. We're not going to make it look as good, but it's going to work.
I think that's the thing. I mean, I always say that I don't support IE6, but I never release a site, you know, for a client and, you know, even my own without testing it in IE6, just to see, you know, what it looks like and things like that. You know, as much as we hate it, and the browser is like 10 years old now, as much as we hate it, you know, I think it's still going to be the bane and the big weight we're still going to have to carry on our shoulders, unfortunately. But going back to the normalized.css, I think, you know, as with regards to the reset.css, like the normalize, I think it's a nice, smooth, less harsh approach to, you know, getting all your fonts and things like that all working well. So, well, it's not just the fonts, obviously, it's other elements, but, you know, you get what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
So if you haven't checked out HTML5 Boilerplate, highly recommend it. Go take a look at it. And even if you don't use the whole thing packaged up together, you can easily pick pieces out that you find useful and give them a try. So, well, we've come to the end of the podcast. We want to try doing something new where we give shout outs to some of our biggest fans. If you are on Twitter and you mention Talentopoly with the hashtag Talentopoly podcast at the end of that tweet, then we will randomly select one of those tweets and mention you on a future podcast episode. So definitely get those tweets out there, and we look forward to hearing from you guys and giving you shout-outs. As always, check out talentopoly.com, post a link to something you're reading or a tool you find useful, and maybe we'll mention it on next week's podcast. Thank you for listening.
Righto.